Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray, and on this week's show, we'll be taking a look at the freshly reauthorized Section 702 of the FISA Act. As you'll soon hear, the updated section now allows the FBI to search data captured under 702 programs, and that data can be used as evidence against US citizens in a bunch of circumstances, including, drumroll please, in cases involving cybersecurity. The co-founder of the Lawfare blog and law professor and associate dean for academic affairs at the University of Texas, Bobby Chesney, will be along in this week's feature interview to talk about all of that. In this week's sponsor interview, we're joined by Haroon Mir of Thinkst Canary. Haroon will be along to talk about where we're at with Canary tokens or Honey tokens, whatever you want to call them. Thinkst has been playing around with this stuff for a couple of years now, and Haroon will be joining us to talk about how these things will wind up being used in an enterprise context. How do you get detection canaries to scale? That is coming up later. But first, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news headlines with Adam Boileau. And Adam, you know, it's not the case that we were just going to talk about Spectre and Meltdown once and then move on, because patching this thing, from a microcode level at least, has turned into a rolling nightmare. Thanks, Intel.
Yeah, it does not seem to have gone particularly well for everybody. Intel, for its part, has recalled or is not providing some of the patches it released earlier, microcode updates for CPUs and corresponding BIOS updates, and a bunch of the OEMs, Dell, HP, etc., have also stopped issuing patches and are encouraging people to not continue to patch whilst they figure out, you know, a bunch of performance and stability issues relating to those.
And yeah, blue screens everywhere, right? Like, it's just been a nightmare.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, like, you know, I guess this is not surprising given the kind of, you know, fairly sort of fundamental architectural nature of these issues, that it would, you know, was going to be complicated to patch, and in particular that there would be, you know, older bits of hardware or edge cases or stuff that was going to go horribly wrong.
It's brain surgery at scale.
Yeah, well, exactly, yeah, right. I mean, I'm having to do this whilst everything's still running and everyone still, you know, expects the internet to work, right? This is hard.
Yeah, it is. And Linus Torvalds, meanwhile, doesn't think much of the Linux patches designed to, you know, mitigate Spectre.
Yeah, there's been a lot of column inches devoted to Linus, you know, being Linus on the LKML mailing list, calling the patches utter garbage. There's actually kind of a bunch of discussion, robust discussion, as they like to have, on the LKML about the ways that they can fix it. They've come up with a technique for implementing fixes for one of the cases that's significantly better than what Intel is proposing. And there's a bunch of arguments about how they're going to do it and whether it's going to work on everything. In particular, the Intel Skylake architecture has some differences from other systems that make it kind of challenging. But anyway, there's a whole bunch of very interesting technical minutiae on that list. But yes, Linus, as he does, has quite strong opinions, and everyone's, you know, enjoying watching the kernel people thrash out exactly what they're going to do.
So he's sticking with his whole shtick of being really approachable and friendly?
Well, it's kind of his jam, I guess.
Now, look, we are loath to cover too much about cryptocurrency here at Risky Biz HQ, but there's some interesting reports sort of circulating about this so-called Tether coin. Now, this is a crypto token whose value is supposed to represent a dollar, right? So the idea is, you know, when you sell your Bitcoin, you're actually exchanging them for these Tether tokens on many exchange platforms. Now, this means that you've got this organization, Tether, responsible for issuing these tokens, and they say, you know, for each token that they issue, they've got a dollar in their bank account to cover it, right? Which sounds great, but I'm a little bit sus, and a bunch of people are becoming a little bit sus on just how well these guys are audited. And we've seen a flurry of stories just in the last week, and you know, people were flagging concerns with this last year. But certainly what it seems like is happening is a lot of exchanges are moving to this Tether model where they're substituting, you know, dollars for tethers, and the dollars actually wind up with Tether. And you're thinking, well, if they keep it one-to-one, that's great. But if they actually start spending some of that cash or withdrawing some of that cash, they're basically heading towards a fractional reserve system, which is what Bitcoin was designed to combat, right? So just a situation developing that I think is kind of worth talking about, because you would expect, or you would hope, regulators might take a look at this.
Yeah, it really does seem like a bit of a mess. I mean, I hadn't expended a lot of time thinking about Tether, but I did a bunch of reading when we were preparing for this news recording. And yeah, it's interestingly enough, this Tether coin is actually founded by the same people who run the Bitfinex trading platform for Bitcoin. And it seems to be primarily a tool to avoid having to interact with US dollar banks who dropped Bitfinex. And, you know, I think Wells Fargo was the bank of Bitfinex, and they decided not to process transactions, and they needed a way to still be able to trade in US dollars, and this was the result. And yeah, the graphs do seem to look like they're propping up the value of Bitcoin by issuing fake US dollar Tether tokens.
Yeah, like there's a Twitter account called Tether Printer, which just, you know, every time they do a big issue, this bot tweets about it. And I think they pumped out about 100 mil yesterday. I think we're up to about $2 billion worth of Tether in circulation. Now, this could all be sort of legit, right? I mean, I'm not suggesting that they're involved in some sort of awful criminality or market manipulation here, but the point is, plenty of people are, but the point is we don't know. And they say they're audited, but they're incorporated in Hong Kong with offices in California. So who knows, right? So,
well, exactly.
You just wouldn't see this sort of situation if regulators had caught up, right? You would know. Now, if they are being properly audited, great, but we just don't know, yeah?
Yeah, we don't, right? And maybe some people will hack them and we'll find out a bit more. We saw some data about the setup of Tether and Bitfinex in the Panama Papers, I think. There was some data in there. And of course, we've seen also both Bitfinex and Tether get owned. I think Bitfinex back in 2016, Tether towards the end of last year. At that point, they actually suspended trading into and out of their Tether platform, unless you've got really, really lots of money. Yeah, it just doesn't smell good at all.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, there's a few people making the assertion that every time there's a Tether print, the Bitcoin price tends to have a habit of getting defended along the lines of the same amount, right? So, you know, whether or not this is a giant cash exfil scam or a really ingenious solution to swapping, you know, crypto coins for, you know, a pseudo fiat currency, I mean, we just don't know. And I guess that's why I'm wanting to talk about it, is because we just don't know. So it's funny, eh? Because Bitcoin was all about draining the swamp and, you know, moving to a post-regulation world. And it's just, you know, it's being scammed in every way you can think of. Now, speaking of that, we've seen some stats. There's a low side and a high side estimate for just how much money has been stolen from ICOs. This low side estimate that CyberScoop has written up says that about $370 million of ICO proceeds, or about 10%, has actually been pinched, which is, you know, it's a fair bit of cash.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. I mean, even regardless of the value, 10% of the ICO input being nicked is really no way to run an economy.
No, it's a little bit higher, but we've seen another report from the Sydney Morning Herald here that says something like, if you include Bitcoin theft, you know, the total is something like $1.5 billion, you know, over time, or about 14% of cryptocurrency. So yeah, there's certainly some fraud going on out there. Well, direct theft and probably some financial crimes as well, right? So this is turning into a pretty interesting old situation. I just get a feeling that a day of reckoning is coming, like something's going to collapse. Now, look, we're going to move on from the cryptocurrency stuff there. As I say, I just wanted to mention it because just every time you look at it, it looks slightly sketchier and the potential for disaster has sort of grown 10%.
And we do love disaster on this show.
Yeah, that's, we're in the disaster covering business, right? But I want to talk about this really interesting piece, which was run by BuzzFeed News. And they've worked with Medusa, the Russian publisher, and they've written this really compelling story titled Inside the Fight for the Soul of Kaspersky Lab. This is a blockbuster piece. Unfortunately, I feel like some of the details might be off, but I can certainly attest to the broad strokes of this piece. You know, it sort of confirms and backs up things I've heard from various sources over the years. But Adam, why don't you give the listeners a bit of a rundown on this piece? Because it is just fascinating.
Yeah, it is. And it fills in a whole bunch of gaps in the story of Kaspersky and kind of how we ended up in, how they ended up in the mess that they are at the moment. So the story goes through, I guess, sort of the rise of Kaspersky, you know, becoming a very successful, very technically adept antivirus company and eventually internet security company. And then at some point, they kind of got a little too successful and attracted a little bit too much attention. And there's always this kind of tension within the company between, you know, those factions that are, you know, sort of Russian and specifically those who've worked in the state services and you know, are sort of patriotically allied to Russia, and all of its, you know, sort of Western investors and employees and people who are, you know, more Western-centric in their approach to things, and technologists and, you know, people who actually wanted to do a really good job of being an antivirus company. There was always this kind of tension between, you know, supporting the national interest and doing a good job technically. And it appears that at some point in the last few years, that kind of tussle came to a head. And it seems like the one of the turning points was Eugene Kaspersky's son got kidnapped in Moscow whilst he was walking from the train station. And then obviously, you know, Eugene talked to his, you know, corporate legal people, who happened to be ex-KGB and or ex-FSB, and, you know, they managed to negotiate and, I think, you know, rescue the son unharmed, and that was, you know, a happy ending for an otherwise, you know, really, you know, I'm sure a very terrifying period for Kaspersky and his wife and his son. But yeah, that kind of seems like, according to the story, that that was a turning point that led to, you know, a rise of the, you know, Russian-aligned factions within Kaspersky, a purge amongst the leadership of people who are more pro-Western, cancelling of their plans for an IPO offering and kind of diversification out into the West. And we end up potentially with, you know, a Kaspersky that is much more pro-Russian and much less global.
Yeah, and it's interesting too that they say that one of the suspects in the kidnapping case has actually since said that the kidnapping was orchestrated by the government. Now, I'm not sure how much stock to put into those claims, because there's a few things in this story that don't quite add up. Like, they mentioned that during a demo, they talked about pulling information off Gamma Group's computers. And I'm like, what? Russia is, you know, what the hell's going on?
Yeah, well, that's another one of the interesting bits in this story is, right, the when Kaspersky deployed their kind of cloud-based learning system that, you know, let people submit samples up or let the agent, you know, grab samples and send them up to the network for analysis itself, which is the exact tooling that it's asserted was used to steal the NSA docs that then made their way to the shadow brokers. There's a sort of offhand mention in this piece that they demoed it internally by stealing source code from Gamma Group, of course, made, you know, hacking tools which they then sell to other governments and things. Like, that's by itself quite an interesting data point. And yeah, it's really just a sort of an aside mention in this story with no real details. And yeah, that, you know, that exact modus operandi is what, of course, we now think that the shadow brokers, or that we now know that was the Hal Martin data, ends up at Kaspersky and then somehow shadow brokers happen.
Well, I mean, it's all theories, right? And I'm not even sure about that data point, whether they're talking about a demo after the Phineas Fisher doxing or what the hell's going on. But that's the thing that makes me cautious, is there's a few blockbuster data points in here that aren't really explained, which makes me sort of question some of the details in the piece. That said, what I can say is, look, about 10 years ago, just under, I was flown business class, thank you very much, to St. Petersburg for a Kaspersky junket. Now, they were spending big in terms of, like, trying to form relationships with journalists and, you know, bribe us a little bit with the red carpet. And this was clearly because they were planning an IPO. The entire company was geared towards going IPO. And then at some point, and they were going to push into the enterprise in a major way. And at some point, man, things just really changed. And I don't think it had a lot to do with the economic turmoil at the time. And it was never really explained. It was very strange. I did see a number of other relationships scuttled. There were certainly moves by Kaspersky to push into other markets, non-Western markets, that were very aggressive and then U-turned without much explanation. So this story and the overall theme of it does explain an awful lot. And I would recommend that listeners who are interested in this whole Kaspersky stuff read it. I mean, you would have to say that, right?
Yeah, like, regardless of whether it's correct on every factual point, which, I mean, as you say, like, there are bits where it may well not be, it's absolutely worth a read because it really does explain, you know, some missing parts of the story.
It does.
Unfortunately, it reads quite believably to me.
Now, the Australian government's been having a bit of a hard time over the last week when it was revealed that the Electoral Commission was told by the Australian Signals Directorate, our NSA, that their security wasn't up to scratch. Now, look, I'd expect ASD to say that because, you know, we're all learning here that elections are something that you need to really lock down. But the Australian Electoral Commission's response to that was to spend $8.6 million hand-counting ballots, which makes me confused as to why people are so angry with the government because it seems like the appropriate response. What's your take on this?
Well, yeah, right. I mean, that's why you have a paper ballot, so that you can verify it by hand and you don't have to rely on the technology, and hopefully it's less likely to get hacked through that particular vector. So yeah, that seems like a responsible thing to do to me. I mean, whether or not they procured the, you know, transport of the papers correctly per the, you know, whatever procurement process, I guess that's a Australian specific issue, I don't know. But yeah, like, that seems quite reasonable. This is why we have paper ballots, so that you can verify it.
Yeah, no, I don't quite get why people are jumping up and down about that one. Facebook is calling for research proposals in security, which could be pretty interesting. And I'm sure there's some listeners who might want to put their hand up for that.
Yeah, apparently there's going to be a program that they're going to announce the people who are going to get grants at Black Hat this year. They're talking like, I think, up to $100,000 per grant for the things that they're after. They don't really have an upper limit on how many they're going to do, so that's pretty cool. Certainly not the first time Facebook have done this kind of thing. They've done some research grant processes in the past. So yeah, if you've got interesting ideas to kind of help the sorts of problems that Facebook have, then yeah, you might be able to get some funding to work on them.
CyberScoop has reported on an interesting statistic from Google. Google has said that less than 10% of its users turn on two-factor auth, which, I don't know, I'm kind of like, I know this is supposed
seems
to be
pretty
a,
good.
Yeah, right? Like, it's supposed to seem like, oh my God, that's not many, but 1 in 10 Google users, that's a lot of people.
That is a lot of people, right? And there's loads of Google accounts that are, you know, one-offs or throwaways or spam registered ones or rubbish, you know. 10% is pretty good because it means there's actual people using them, right? So it's got to be more than 10% of real users. So yeah, that seems pretty good to me. It's more than I would have expected.
Looks like a Lebanese APT crew has been busted. We always like it when that happens.
Yeah, apparently their OPSEC, not too flash. A bunch of the command and control infrastructure was fairly well attributable to them, right down to the fact that they were using the wireless network in an office building next door to where the Lebanese general director of general security was based. So, yeah, might want to take some OPSEC lessons there, guys.
Now, there's this web application platform called Electron, which is apparently quite popular. I can't say I'm too familiar with it, but apparently there's some bugs in it, which is affecting apps like Skype and Slack and all sorts of things. You know, and we see these things like framework bugs are a pretty big deal because it relies on everyone who's written those apps to sort of, you know, redo their app with a new framework, and sometimes it breaks things and whatever. But what can you tell us about this situation, Adam?
So Electron's really interesting because it's a framework for writing thick client apps using the technology stack from web systems. So you write like JavaScript and HTML and CSS, and then you deploy it as a compiled client-side app that kind of uses a browser behind the scenes to do it. And so it's quite popular with hipster devs, obviously. And so, yeah, things like the Slack client, the Skype on Windows uses it as well. And so there's a bunch of other things. It's quite a popular framework. But the interesting thing about this, I guess, is the bug is in a hipster framework for writing apps, but the bug is in when they register protocol handlers with the browser. So like the /:// protocol handler, it's straight up command injection in the protocol handler, which is such a 90s bug. So yeah, that's why it's, you know, this is a fun story because, yeah, hipster framework, 90s bug, hilarity ensues.
So yeah, people are going to have to get on top of that, I'd imagine, right? Because that's
The Slack one, I guess, is the Slack case is the worst. But basically, any Electron app that also registers a protocol handler is probably vulnerable to a straight up command inject.
Yeah. Oh, there's a Chrome extension kicking around, a malicious one that apparently is virtually impossible to manually remove. And we've seen, you know, the deck on this Ars Technica story says extensions remain the Achilles heel for an otherwise highly secure browser. You'd have to agree with that, right? Because every time we're talking about a serious issue affecting Chrome, it's always an extension.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, Google needs to be a bit more aggressive at curating the extensions that are allowed to go into the store because, yeah, this is a real problem.
But that's hard, man. That is, like, legit hard to do that at such huge scale, right?
Well, sure, and maybe they need to dial back the scale, right? I mean, maybe it needs to cost $50,000, $100,000 to put an extension in the store, and it should be a thing that there should be 10 of them total, maybe. You know.
But that's, you're sounding like a beardy guy, right? Like, you're sounding like a proper beardy Unix guy saying stuff like that. I don't, you know, that's just not realistic. But, I mean, is there a way to re-architect them so that these things are less of an issue? But it just seems like an inherent problem. If you're going to let stuff in, you know, really hook into your browser, you're going to have a bad time if there are malicious people
that's
putting...
That's why this is why extensions exist as opposed to the sorts of, you know, like add-ons, which are just built in straight browser tech and don't have any need for privileged access. Like, this is why we have extensions and plugins so that they could do things they're not supposed to.
Yeah, well, that's it, right? So, I mean, but the thing is, you charge a $50,000 admission fee, you know, you're just going to kill innovation. But it might be nice if there were a whitelisted, you know, if you could just use whitelisted extensions that Google has actually looked at.
Yeah, I mean, there's got to be some options, right? I mean, code signing was totally going to solve malware, right? So
totally, man. Problem solved. Oh, here's an interesting story from Andy Greenberg over at Wired, and I've seen this one kicking around at a few other outlets as well. Tinder apparently doesn't actually HTTPS encrypt the photos that users are swiping. And, of course, even though it's an encrypted, the rest of the traffic is encrypted, they can tell from the number of bytes whether or not someone has swiped left, swiped right, or matched. And that seems like a bit of a privacy problem.
Well, yeah, it just seems really dumb. Like, what year is it that you are that worried that you wouldn't just HTTPS everything? I mean, are you really CPU constrained because you've been meltdown patching everything or what? You know, just crypto everything.
I remember once actually at a KiwiCon, we were sitting around in the hotel room and just dumping Facebook Messenger traffic, our own, right? Just to make that clear, just to see what was encrypted. And this is before Snowden and before HTTPS, like on everything, was the cool thing to do. And it was something similar, you know, like the little profile icons and stuff were all popping up in clear text, but the actual messages ran over HTTPS. But you just got to wonder in 2018 why you wouldn't just, you know, encrypt everything. It seems pretty dumb.
Yeah, you should just encrypt everything in year 2018. Like, we are well past the time when anything is okay in the clear. And I think this example is good because there are only a very few options of things you're going to be doing, you know, swipe left, swipe right, whatever. And that lets you do, you know, metadata analysis based on size. So that's quite cool. I mean, as a technique. I mean, on a more complicated app, you wouldn't be able to do that. But it's just dumb. Like, the fix is easy. Turn on SSL everywhere, please.
Yeah, good idea. DNS rebinding flaws. Tavis is still having some fun there. Blizzard Entertainment has apparently patched their update agent against a DNS rebinding attack that Tavis discovered, but he says they patched it wrong.
Yeah, well, obviously Tavis does have lots of opinions about things, and he's probably right. But yeah, Blizzard may not have taken that the way that they would like to. But yeah, Tavis versus gaming industry, and you know, even just with one bug, DNS rebinding is going to be a bad time. And when he goes buck wild against Steam, which I'm assuming he probably already has, and there's 100 bugs filed with Valve, all of which give out code exec. It's just going to be a bloodbath. And this is, we're going to do this every week, I imagine, for the next 6 months whilst he wrecks the entire gaming industry. So yeah, good on you.
Yeah, well, it was torrent clients last week. So if you reckon that there could be a DNS rebinding flaw in, you know, any element of your software, you might want to look at that before he does. Now, we're going to end the week's news with our so-called skateboarding dog story. And we're going to talk about a British 15-year-old kid named Kane Gamble. He was part of the so-called Crackers with Attitude group. And look, he really did some wonderful social engineering here to, among other things, gain access to the accounts of, you know, various figures in the intelligence community. But he also got access to the Leap database from the FBI, which is like, he should not have been able to get that far, right? Like, there's one thing taking over some public servant's AOL account, you know, that's one thing, but actually getting real intelligence information, even if it is at the lower end, that shouldn't happen.
Yeah, like this kid is clearly pretty talented at social, but it's just amazing how much stuff he got into, just using Common Garden social technique and, yeah, showing up in the actual FBI, you know, law enforcement portal. Jeez, like that's not a thing that should happen. Oh, God. But, yeah, it's I don't know. Like, it's a bit of a tragic story in a way. I mean, it sounds like the kid is, on the autistic spectrum and – you know, clearly was a bit distanced from the impact of the things he was doing or the risks of the things that he was doing. And unfortunately, yeah, he's going to pay for it. But
luckily,
it's amazing how much stuff.
Luckily, he was 15 when he committed these offences, and luckily he lives in England. So he might not be thrown in a basement for 30 years. So there is that. All right, Adam, that's actually it for this week's news, a relatively easy news week. Thanks a lot for joining us, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, cheers. That's fun. Talk to you next week.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news headlines. Okay, it is time for a chat about the always controversial Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act. Section 702 is a surveillance authority passed in 2008 that allows the National Security Agency to collect information on non-US citizens who are located outside the USA. That said, the authority allows the NSA to capture this data on US soil from a fiber tap upstream or from companies like Google and Facebook under the so-called PRISM program. I guess that makes it downstream. The Section 702 authority is not to be confused with Executive Order 1233, which authorizes much of the US intelligence community's collection outside of the USA. So yes, 702 is a surveillance authority that allows for warrantless wiretapping of people without the court having to approve individual selectors, but it cannot be used against US citizens. Think of it this way. If Osama bin Laden had a Facebook account, surveillance of that account would have been conducted under a 702 authority. But, of course, some data on American citizens will wind up in databases collected under 702 authority. If bin Laden was having a Facebook Messenger chat with his US citizen pal in New York, that's going to get caught. So there is some incidental collection. It gets even messier when you start talking about so-called about collection, which, due to the way deep packet inspection works on serious internet tubes, means you're going to wind up with a bunch of basically random internet user data in your database. In other words, it is all a little bit complicated and messy. Now, of course, Edward Snowden really threw a spotlight on 702 collection when he leaked the kitchen sink back in 2013. And while I and a bunch of others were initially taken aback during that period, I think what I learned is that, yes, a non-loyally outsider's reading of the authority makes it look ripe for abuse. But in reality, the oversight actually seems pretty good. Of course, it's not perfect, but it's not like what Glenn Greenwald made it seem like in his breathless coverage for The Guardian and The Intercept. As you've probably heard, Section 702 has just been reauthorized. It has a built-in sunset that requires its reauthorization every so often, and this time the debate around the reauthorization has actually been pretty interesting. And I think we can partially thank Snowden for that, because the debate hasn't really been around whether or not 702 should exist at all. It's generally accepted by lawmakers that it or something like it is needed. But this time the discussion is mostly centered on the possible use of information about US citizens incidentally collected via 702 as evidence in criminal justice proceedings. And that, well, that sounds pretty unsettling and worth asking a few questions about. Joining me to discuss the renewal of 702 is the co-founder of the Lawfare blog, law professor and associate dean for academic affairs at the University of Texas Austin, Bobby Chesney. As you'll hear, to me, it sounds alarming, but Bobby says in practice, it's probably okay, mostly because the 702 data set on US citizens isn't as big as people think it is. Here he is.
It's not part of the original sort of Snowden surge of interest in this area. It's something that began to come to light a little bit later, especially thanks to the work of what we call the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, or PCLOB, as we lovingly refer to it. PCLOB is this body of sort of outside experts with rich experience in some cases in this field, who are reasonably credible as sort of neutral arbiters who have access to all the classified information about how it all works. They did a series of reports and investigations, both about the bulk metadata program and about the 702 program, and basically said, look, the bulk metadata program is problematic in various ways, isn't worth the candle. 702, in contrast, extremely valuable collection going on there, and not a lot to be concerned about. But they did flag a few things where they were a little bit concerned. And one of them, they drew attention to the fact that the fruits of 702 collection, which are, just to remind ourselves, meant to be foreign intelligence, you know, for foreign intelligence purposes, that the FBI could access this, including for criminal investigations in some cases. And that struck a lot of people as wrong. It seemed kind of odd that you could do a U.S. person name query of the fruits of 702 collection and then turn around and perhaps even use that as evidence in a criminal case.
Well, I mean, one of the reasons we're supposed to feel comfortable about governments having the reach that they do to be able to, you know, pick up intelligence on so many people is because it can't be used as evidence. You know, the thinking is, well, the NSA can't put you in jail. So I guess when people hear, hey, the FBI can all of a sudden query this data set, I mean, that seems like a really reasonable thing to get your back up about.
Well, you know, it's kind of a question of scale. And here's what I mean by this. So before 702, which does pull in a large, vast amount of information, we had already the FISA system. And this is the one where you've got either a U.S. person target in the United States, or the collection is on a wire and it's in the United States with one end foreign. And those foreign intelligence collections go through a court approval process that's not a regular criminal warrant. But as long as it all goes in the way the statute says it's supposed to, the government can and sometimes does use the fruits of that collection in criminal prosecutions. And indeed, since 9/11, it's gotten much easier to do that for a variety of complicated reasons. So this sort of idea that maybe you're not allowed to originally go about building your criminal case using the foreign intelligence tools as your main thing, but you nonetheless get to benefit from them on the back end. There was a version of that idea in place. It just didn't arise a great deal, didn't seem to implicate a large swath of U.S. person privacy interests. 702, especially once the P Club started drawing attention to FBI's access, it began to seem to many people that, you know, there's probably a vast amount of information you ultimately get for various reasons about U.S. person communications in the 702 database. And if they can just freely or to some extent easily access and query that database, this is potentially problematic. Now, of course, the government says, look, it's not that easy. We don't just willy-nilly access it. This became something that really got people going. And it's probably been one of the three or four biggest issues that made it really unclear whether 702 was even going to get renewed on time over the past month.
Yeah. Now, look, I mean, I just want to backtrack on a couple of things you've said there. I mean, I can understand how information obtained under a FISA warrant could find its way into a criminal trial because at least a court has issued a warrant for a person, right?
Right.
That makes sense. In the case of 702, there's no warrants there. Now, what I'm wondering, does the FBI have to apply for some sort of warrant to query a 702 data set for specific selectors, or can they just go fishing?
They didn't used to, and as of President Trump signing this new statute into law a few days ago, now they do in some limited circumstances. So let me just kind of cut right to the heart of that. Here's the new rule, and this is hot off the presses. Advocates for privacy interests had hoped for an across-the-board warrant requirement. That is, if FBI wants to search for any U.S. person identifier in the fruits of 702 collection, they got to go get a warrant based on the usual probable cause to believe there's, you know, evidence of a crime. They didn't get that. They got a partial version of it. There's no warrant required in the following circumstances. FBI is doing a national security investigation. If that's the case, no warrant. And by the way, that raises an interesting question. Which investigations count as national security related? There's a lot of reason to believe, for example, that basically all cybersecurity related criminal activity might be assimilated into that larger category, which is really something. And I know a lot of your listeners would be interested in that. Secondly, no warrant required if whatever the criminal investigation's about, the collection might help avert or minimize threat to life or body, bodily harm, serious injury. And of course, that's going to cover a lot of criminal investigation too, not everything, but between those two carve outs, that's a pretty big deal. And then the third carve out is the new warrant requirement only comes into place when the FBI has reached sort of what they call the predicated investigation stage, which means it's more than just the initial assessment. It's not just the initial inquiry into whether you want to open a case. So somewhat counterintuitively, you might say it looks like they're free to go without a warrant to query the database. When they're at that preliminary stage, and it's only when the investigation steps up to the next level that they potentially encounter the warrant requirement. Now, that's not at all what a lot of the advocacy groups were hoping they would get. And so that's why you're hearing that a lot of people are not at all happy with this end result.
So I want to talk for a second about how we define actual collection, right? Because it's not actually the way, you know, most people would think of it. So, you know, you've got programs where there's vast amounts of information being ingested by various NSA systems. Just because it's been ingested and written onto a disk somewhere, until that thing is actually processed and sorted as per certain selectors, it's not actually considered collected, is it?
There's a lot of debate about the terminology that's being used and the extent to which being precise about the internal sort of term of art definitions that are used might make these statutory constraints work in ways other than what you would think on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
For this purpose, I'm not sure that it has a lot of bite. What it boils down to is there are these moments where FBI has somebody, a U.S. person they're interested in. And now, unless you have one of those carve-outs I mentioned a moment ago, they do need to go get a warrant based on the usual probable cause showing of a crime being committed and evidence of a crime before they can get access to any of the fruits of 702 collection. They have to get it from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which is a little odd, but otherwise it looks conventional.
I guess the reason I asked about that is because, you know, some people might be thinking that, you know, this will allow the FBI, pursuant to a warrant, to go and basically grep or just search all of the raw data that passes past anything visible to the NSA, right? Whereas it's more likely that this... this searching or phishing, I'm going to call it, is going to occur against a data set that's a lot smaller, that being the data set that the NSA has decided to keep after having done its initial processing on it, right? So that's a different data set.
The way the warrant requirements written in the statute is really hard to parse. And frankly, I don't feel like I fully understand exactly how it's likely to be interpreted. And in fact, the statute, maybe anticipating there could be questions about this, has a separate provision requiring the Inspector General of the Justice Department to make a report about how the DOJ National Security Division and the FBI decide to interpret the authorities that are being given here. Because all those things I've been mentioning about, you know, exactly when you have to get a warrant and when you don't, in the first instance, it's up to the Justice Department, the FBI, to decide, do they think that the carve-outs apply?
That's not problematic at all.
Well, you know, traditionally you would think, for example, that, well, there will be a back-end protection about abuse, because insofar as they play fast and loose with the language and they go get some information and they then prosecute somebody with it, the defense is going to move to suppress it, not on what you would expect, which is the grounds of Fourth Amendment protection, but in addition to that, at least, they'd move to suppress on the grounds that the statute wasn't properly interpreted to begin with. There is definitely some prospect that over the next, you know, couple of years, we'll begin to see these cases that test things. In the meantime, and I think this shows Congress was anxious about this, in the meantime, the Inspector General of the DOJ has got to, you know, report to Congress on exactly what kind of policies and procedures are adopted. And I should add, the statute also requires the Attorney General and the Director of National Intelligence agree on a set of written policies about all of this.
See, if I'm an American, I'm much more worried about the FBI and the Department of Justice than I am about the NSA, right? Like, I mean, as I said in my intro, I was really taken aback by the revelations that came out in 2013. But having had a bit of time to digest them and also speak to people who used to work at various agencies, like, it just, as you said, it just seems to be a bit of a nothing burger. But this seems much more concerning to me than any use of 702 collected information by the national security apparatus.
Well, at the risk of alarming you further, let me flag another really in the weeds issue that I think some experts would say this is even more alarming to the people who are following this closely. It's one thing when the prosecutors get their hands on information collected and then use it as evidence in the case, because then you are at least going to have some potential to move to suppress it.
Are we going to start talking about parallel construction?
I think we are.
Fantastic. We are. Ding.
So right. There's a real subtle bit in the statute, and I'm going to flip through some papers while I'm chatting with you here so I can find the precise language. There's a section in the new statute that's got a somewhat obscure title, Notifications to Aggrieved Persons. It says that basically within 6 months, the Attorney General has got to come brief the Judiciary and Intelligence Committees to explain how the Justice Department interprets this existing part of the FISA statute, where the Justice Department is basically supposed to notify the people they're prosecuting when they've got evidence, quote, obtained or derived from the FISA process. And if you read it all closely, it looks a lot like what Congress is trying to do is get a grip on just when DOJ discloses the evidence they've got. Maybe it wasn't actually directly the fruits of FISA collection, but maybe the fruits of FISA collection helped tip them off and then enable them in a way they otherwise couldn't do to build a case using other evidence that would come in kind of clean and seemingly unrelated to foreign intelligence, if that makes sense. So they didn't do anything in this new statute to prevent that or to regulate it. It's a call for information, which is also true for a number of other parts of the statute too.
Okay, so, you know, we've laid out the terrifying scenario, which is basically, you know, borderline unfettered FBI access to national security information, you know, originating in from an agency that has more visibility into people's communications than any other organization on the planet, right? Maybe except for Google and Facebook. So, you know, that sounds terrible. Now, what I've often found is the case is that laws like these, even if we don't like them, the government usually has a pretty sensible case. They usually make a pretty sensible case for why those laws are required. What is the government's case in this case? Why is it that they are saying they need this?
Right. So if you remove sort of the questions of scale that comes with the potential size of and quantity of data one could get through the foreign intelligence collection we're talking about, and you just sort of imagine it as a single instance where there's this one government employee standing on one side of the room, and he's got a sheaf of files in front of him, including information that's material for really serious crimes, child pornography, murders, who knows what. And then you've got this other person across the room who doesn't know he's got that, but he's trying to prosecute those crimes. And we, as a society, we absolutely want him to do so. And so the idea that this post-9/11 theme of we got to reduce the barriers to information sharing so that when one side of the house has really material information that you would like the other side to have, you pass it over. And when you imagine this applied in the context of, you know, evidence that the NSA may come across, that there's, say, child pornography going on, what's not to like about getting that into the hands of the prosecutor who can do something about it?
Well, what's not to like is that's not what SIGINT agencies are for, right? And the reason we let them do what they do is because that's not what they're for.
Well, that gets to this post-9/11 controversy about the existence of a wall between foreign intelligence investigators and criminal investigators. And for exactly
talking about counter-espionage and counter-terrorism, I understand that argument, right? I understand wanting to bust down the walls in that case. But when we're talking about things like, you know, selling drugs, when we're talking about things like even like armed robbery or whatever, like it just seems too intrusive. I mean, that's just my gut reaction as a non-lawyer, you know, infosec jerk. But I mean, I guess what I'm trying to gauge here, Bobby, is like how you feel in your heart of hearts about the current status of 702. What's your feel?
So I'm pretty comfortable. I'm sure the listeners can tell that. I'm not terribly worried, although I do think it's very important to actually, there's a lot of data gathering built into this new statute. And I think a lot will be proven up by what that data shows. So I'm reserving a little bit of judgment. But on this question of passing information that if the foreign intelligence collectors in good faith and in compliance with the law and compliance with applicable policies get their hands on stuff that turns out that's material towards at least certain significant categories of crime, then in principle, I don't mind that being passed over. Let me read to you what the categories are.
That's assuming that they stumble across it, right? But I mean, I can imagine a situation where someone from the FBI might say, hey, Bob, you know, over at Fort Meade, maybe take a look at this guy.
Oh, it's more direct than that, I would say. What happens is that the criminal investigator says, hey, Bob, here's this guy, and I either want you to query, or maybe even the system is set up to where I can, with the proper approvals, directly query the database running that name, as long as I make a record that documents why I think I have a sufficient predication to check the 702 database for this. I totally hear you on the idea that, look, we're opening up some possibilities not for criminal investigation purposes. It's not as bad as it perhaps sounds, insofar as you focus on the fact that the 702 collection can't be orchestrated ab initio. It can't be from the outset designed to pull U.S. person information. You can't have a U.S. person target. That much is clear. This gets into the debate then about, yeah, okay, fine. But if the scale of collection in practice basically gets this vast amount of information where a huge amount of U.S. communications can be expected to be there anyways, well, the more you think that's a comprehensive backdoor way of gathering all that U.S. person information, the more concerned we should be. The more you think that there's, relatively speaking, not that much in there relative to the proper stuff, then the less concerned you need to be. And it's hard to judge that from the outside. I do think it's important to make clear the new statute talks about when the Justice Department is allowed to use this stuff as evidence, just as evidence. This is not a constraint on when they can access it for investigative purposes, but when they can go into court with it, here's the list. Cases involving national security again, or death, kidnapping, serious bodily injury, crimes against minors, efforts to damage critical infrastructure, transnational crime, human trafficking, or, wait for it, cybersecurity, including the Computer Fraud Abuse Act, access device fraud, and wiretapping.
Yay! So,
pretty much all the federal stuff that's going to be high priority, with a few exceptions, you know, not too many exceptions, the door's open for this kind of use. Think of it this way. So if I'm investigating some child porn ring, and I think that John Doe U.S. person is involved there, under this framework, not only am I able to, then the question is, can I ask for access to the fruits of 702 collection, period, without getting a warrant? If we limit it to what I just described, well, it's interesting. Does that satisfy the national security consideration? No, that's probably not going to satisfy it. Would it satisfy the death or bodily injury element? That would probably depend on the type of child porn investigation this is. If you actually have like children who are being held, you might get there with bodily injury. But if it's more of a conventional child porn investigation, probably not. So I can't get access to begin with without first going to get a warrant. Now, once I get the warrant, of course, I can use the evidence at trial, but change it over to cybersecurity. So I'm a Computer Fraud and Abuse Act investigation, or I'm involved in one of those. And there will be an interesting interpretive question. Does that count as national security? That's easy, yes, if it's a nation state type scenario. If it's something much more run of the mill, you know, somebody, you know, grabbing credit cards or something, you know, for just their own financial advantage, maybe not, unless the whole category has been swept up into national security, as some people think maybe is the case. So once I've gotten it without the warrant, then it's very clear I'm allowed to use it at trial under this new element of the statute.
So and John Smith, U.S. person, I suspect is involved in contributing to some APT crew based somewhere else around the world. The FBI can ask the NSA to task that person.
Yeah, and if you have an APT tie, I think you'll be able to pretty easily make the national security claim, yeah. Right?
So the NSA can actually do tasking against U.S. citizens at the behest of the...
No, this is a really critical point. They can't task, right?
So okay, that's why I was asking. They can just look for stuff that might have popped up in other investigations.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. They got to rely on the serendipity that guy might already be stuff about him might already be in the hall. And if you get a little bit, as you might, especially if it's some foreign APT situation, you're very likely to come up with something. And then maybe that turns into the predicate that enables you to go use other authorities. You know, you may be able to get your warrant that you otherwise couldn't. Now that you've got a little bit from the fruits of the 702 collection, and that's clearly how this is all designed to work.
So I guess we're just going to have to wait and see when all of the data starts shaking out on how this has all been used and applied. We're going to have to wait and see how it pans out. But I think you made a few people listening to this pretty nervous. Bobby Chesney, thank you very much for joining us on the show to discuss 702.
I love being on and especially getting the chance to make some of the listeners nervous.
That was Bobby Chesney there with a chat about Section 702 surveillance. 6 more years of that. And we didn't even get a chance to talk about all the stuff the DEA is up to surveillance-wise. And I should say, too, that Bobby doesn't expect all courts will just greenlight the use of this material. There's a solid chance these practices will be contested in the future. So, yeah, I guess we just got to wait and see. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with the always wonderful Haroon Mir. Haroon is the evil genius behind Thinkst Canary. You can find them at canary.tools. Regular listeners would know that a Thinkst Canary is a little hardware honeypot you put on your LAN. If someone starts messing with it, you know you've got a problem. Thinkst also recently branched out a bit. They are offering a virtualized canary for cloud deployments, and those things are flying off the virtual shelves. But all the while they've been shipping their canaries, Thinkst has been playing around a lot with what they call canary tokens. The non-branded name for them, I guess, is honey tokens. These are little tripwires you can set up, like an image callback in a document or a hidden URL that only you know. You hide it somewhere sensitive. If it gets hit, you know something's up. The security team at Atlassian actually released some really great tools around AWS canaries. You can generate some AWS access tokens that go nowhere, but if you've got your logging right, you can be alerted when someone tries to use them. So you can just sprinkle them around your infrastructure and wait until someone uses them. Haroon has integrated the AWS stuff into canarytokens.org differently to the way Atlassian has done it, and canary customers can now use those tokens through their consoles. Dan Burke of Atlassian was actually at ShmooCon talking about that stuff over the last week or so, and a bunch of people on Twitter seemed pretty impressed. So well done to you, Dan. But honeypots were basically an InfoSec curiosity until Thinkst turned them into a slick and simple product. Honey tokens are a little bit the same, but I suspect Haroon and the rest of his team at Thinkst are on the cusp of making them usable and scalable, just like they did with honeypots. But as you'll hear, not all honey tokens are created equal. Here's Haroon.
Tokens are pretty mixed bag in terms of effectiveness and noise.
Yeah.
So you'd get some tokens that, yeah, they're going to go off often. And some tokens, like if you create a PDF token and you store it somewhere, there's every chance that your attacker is not using a compliant PDF reader. Like maybe he reads all his PDFs in Python and libpdf. And so now your PDF token's not going to trigger when he reads the PDF document. But at the same time, there's two things at play. One is there's every chance that he does read it in Preview or Adobe, and then you get a message that you otherwise wouldn't have had. And on the other hand, there are some tokens that are absolutely rock solid. And like one of my absolute favorites right now, the AWS token is absolute InfoSec gold.
Yeah, well, I mean, ShmooCon just happened in the last week, and one of those guys, I don't think it was Daniel Jalak, it was his colleague from Atlassian, did that talk at ShmooCon, and I just saw a lot of people jumping up and down on Twitter going, oh, this is amazing, right? They've turned out to be very, very interesting and also very effective from what I hear.
Yeah, like I can't praise that token enough. I'll tell you why I absolutely adore it, and I know you know this, but just for users who haven't looked at it. So the simple concept is someone goes, creates the token, and either the guys at Atlassian or we, depending on who you're getting it from, essentially give you fake AWS creds. And you get it in a nice AWS creds package. And the moment those creds are used, you get a notification that tells you somebody just used these creds. And of course, if you're doing it with Canary tokens, the whole point is you'd get one and say, leaving this on CEO's machine, leaving this on CFO's machine, leaving this on web server 23. And at some point, you get a message telling you the fake AWS creds on web server 23 just got used. And why they absolute gold is because if I was on your CEO's machine and I saw these AWS creds, there's zero chance of me ignoring them. I absolutely have to try because it's probably access to your entire AWS.
Mm.
And on top of that, there's no way to know that they fake creds because, well, they real creds.
Yeah, they just don't get you anywhere, right? And I saw a couple of attackers, actually. I have seen over the last few months a couple of attackers on Twitter saying things like, you know, I've got some AWS creds here, but I have no idea if they're honey tokens or not. And it is, you know, and they're legit people, right, doing paid pen testing gigs, but they're looking at these things going, oh, man, you know, like, I don't know whether I should use these or not. And that's a powerful thing to be able to do that to an attacker who thinks, well, these creds, you know, they're a little bit easy to find, like the real ones would be, but, you know, they could be bullshit and I could be about to end my whole adventure if I use them.
It's absolutely beautiful. And there's no reason to not spray them around, right?
Like, yeah,
put one on every, and part of the hidden joy just with this AWS kit, like why I love it so much is if you have a non-technical CEO and like you put this AWS creds in his home directory in .aws, he's never going to touch it. He doesn't know what to do with that text file. But you can bet that the attacker who takes him does.
Okay, so we know AWS tokens are the new cool, but you've had a couple of years to look at this stuff now. Like, what scales? What doesn't? What showed promise but then didn't really work? Like, I'm curious to know what you've learned, because the whole plan for Thinxt is to take these honey tokens and eventually turn them into a commercial service or a value add commercial service and keep honeytokens.org for free. So you would have learned a lot by now. Like, what are those key takeaways?
Yeah, so interestingly enough, there's a bunch of tokens that if I were a blue teamer or if I were defending the network, I'd consider working on. And they'd give you really great bang for your buck, but they wouldn't scale for us building stuff like this. And if you ever get a chance, you should buy the Gruck a drink or spend some time talking to the Gruck, because he's got a virtual ton of them. Like way down to some really great ideas, like fake services on your internal networks that are just tokens. There's a whole bunch of goodness that's going to come out of the wash there, but they absolutely don't scale. We played with some of them really early on when we did this talk. For example, you can buy Google ads or Bing ads against certain topics and then leak those topics in sensitive areas. So we demoed this with a hash, for example. So you could have a banner throw a certain hash, like Paul's web server 01. And when someone searches for Paul's web server 01, Google or Bing show them the ad that you've placed against Paul's web server 01. And then they charge you for it. So you get a ping that tells you somebody just Googled for the server.
Man.
And the only way they know that that server exists is because they saw it on your network.
That is cool. Because, I mean, often we just take things and throw them into Google. Like, it might even be, yeah, that's fantastic. That works. Have you done that?
Yes. So we demoed this in 2015. Unfortunately, when we did it, you could only do it against Bing. Google, because they figure this is going on, won't show you stuff for really low volume hits. But for example, recently, Colin Molyneux, who used to work at Square, did an entire talk on what he calls reverse engineering canaries. And he had some interesting slides, because what Colin basically does is he throws tokens into random binary or into binaries at different stages. So you almost build a CTF out of canaries that you're embedding in your code. And so the first one you might get if you just strings the binary. And the second one you get if you actually run through its decrypt loop or its little decode loop. And essentially, Colin's thesis is you can tell the sophistication of the attacker coming after you because he hits your token. And he's got an interesting slide where he goes, if you find this random endpoint in the code, are you not going to throw it into Google? And he goes through, he says, like, follow any reverse engineering project, like how I reverse engineered firmware X. And you'll see valid steps along the way that go, I found this URL, I Googled it, I found people discussing it in forum X.
But hang on, saying that Google won't show you like a single one, or have they fixed that now? Have they changed that?
Yeah. So Google's fixed that. Bing still hasn't. So if you get a single result, Bing will charge me for it. Google will not charge me for it.
So there's no way to use Google to do this, or?
Yeah, you can't. So you can't use Google for the ad hash, but essentially what you can do is still make that URL a token, right? So the guy's going to see it on Google.
Yeah, and then they're going to hit the URL and you go, whoop, whoop, whoop.
Yeah, exactly. And you're going to find out that this guy just hit that.
So hang on. These are cool next level tricks, right? But I'm curious to know, for the average CISO, right? I mean, AWS tokens sound like, yeah, you're going to have to do that. What about things like SSH keys, doc tokens? Like, what are the ones that you would recommend? Like, say I'm a CISO from a financial services company with 2,000 employees. What are the tokens that you're going to recommend I use and deploy in my infrastructure?
Yeah, so really the simple ones, the word tokens, the doc tokens, are no-brainers. Like they can be used, and because of the way we've built Canary tokens, and more importantly, the token server, this stuff's Python scriptable for us, scriptable for the customer. So with ours, literally the customer gets to say, okay, let's create 1,000 PDF docs and put one on every desktop in the organization. And we can attribute so it's hidden, because literally it's one line of Python and pushing to whatever your Windows deployment tool is. But you can put a Word doc on there that's fake access to the intranet.pdf. And essentially what it means is when that stuff gets hit, you should take a better look at it. One of the tokens that's super valuable that more people should be using on our site is the cloned website token. And it sounds more complex than it is, but essentially you put a token into your website or into your Microsoft Outlook web access site. And when someone clones that site and runs it on their infrastructure.
Yeah, to make it look like a phishing page. Yeah, no, that's that makes sense.
And it works ridiculously well. I'm not sure if I mentioned, but we've got like a really nice customer, like one of the Silicon Valley unicorns, And running our canaries, they caught their red team company initially on day one of the assessment. And so red team company was like all muffed about it. We'll get you next time, blah, blah, blah. And we were a little nervous because how do we do better than day one of the assessment? And on their next engagement, they literally caught them, I think it was 3 days before the engagement started. Because what red teamers did was they cloned their websites in anticipation.
Yeah.
Ran it on their infrastructure.
I mean, so that's just like such a pain in the ass, right? Because now you're going to have to hit the clone that you've created with Burp Suite in like lockdown mode to try to catch the leak, right? It's just another level of crap you have to do that most people aren't going to bother with, at least for the next few years.
And it's exactly what you want to do, right? Like, although you probably have to drink when I say it, you're raising the bar, right? And
increasing the cost of the attacker, blah, 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 blah. So when are we going to say, when are you going to turn this into a more fully fledged commercial service? Because I understand you do, Honey Token integration for Canary customers so that they can pull that into their Canary console. But when are you going to be sort of going a little bit more commercial with the, say, the provisioning?
Yeah, so we're working on some stuff now that later this year will show up on canarytokens.org. So right now, our Canary customers get their own token server and they get some measure of integration built in. So if they create a Windows server or a disk station NAS, they can automatically provision tokens onto it. But we're hatching some stuff now that we'll release later in this year. So that canarytokens.org itself, or maybe we'll give it a new domain, can actually hit the site, deploy tokens, and lots of the ideas that we've got for tokens or that we've been suggesting to people, we're starting to automate.
Yeah. So that helps with scale, right? So that's a big
exactly
thing.
Exactly right.
Now, look. Speaking of scale, you and I were talking earlier, and it's funny, right? Because I think late last year we spoke about how you've launched virtual canaries that people can plug into their, cloud infrastructure, which is great. And you're saying that people are buying like an order of magnitude more of these than just the hardware ones because that's the nature of cloud infrastructure. They've proved to be a bit of a hit, right?
Yeah, they're doing surprisingly well. Like when
I'm not surprised. I mean, it's a great idea, but go on.
No. When we launched the Cloud Canaries, one of the things I was worried about is that in the cloud world, attacks. So we used to the concept of someone breaks into a machine and then looks around, and that sounds like you breaking into data centers. And it doesn't sound like cloud infrastructure because suddenly it's a question of, well, if you're one of the cloud, what happens now? And we've started to get, it's interesting because most of the discussions around Cloud Canary, literally, like you say, it's an order of magnitude more. So people test it, they like it, and then they go, well, can we get N100 of these? And what you find is lots of people who've built their architectures around disparate or distinct VPCs are now asking the question, once they see Canary in action, they go like, well, that would be interesting. If someone broke into one of these VPCs and looked around, they could hit a Canary just as easily. And yeah, it's quick, it's painless, and it gives you the Canary love. So it's been doing really well for us. And we've found some goodness already, so we're pretty happy with it.
Well, there you go. Haroon Mia, we're out of time, but it's been a pleasure to chat to you as always. And I think we're chatting again in something like 4 weeks. And I think you and I earlier, we've already discussed what we're going to talk about, and that's going to be a good one as well. But look, thank you very much for joining us on the show to walk us through the latest with where things are at with Honey Tokens. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Look forward to it, Pat.
That was Haroon Mia there of Thinks to Canary. Big thanks to him for that. You can generate some Honey Tokens for free at canarytokens.org, and you can check out Thinks' commercial offerings at canary.tools. I accidentally said honeytokens.org during that interview too, and it is, in fact, canarytokens.org. But yeah, that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.